the case of Sanchez against Prudential Pizza. Mr. Brown.
May it please the court. Defendant here was not prudent. It was imprudent. Ambiguous. The defendant should bear the burden of the ambiguity it created by its silence on fees. And in the language of its Rule 68 offer, Judge Posner held in the Nordby case cited by counsel in their brief that the prudent defendant, however, will mention in a Rule 68 offer them being attorney's fees and costs explicitly in order to head off the type of appeal that we've been wrestling with here. Yet here we are again wrestling with the same type of appeal. And the effect of Merrick and Webb v. James and Nordby on ambiguous offers is clear. Judge Posner in Nordby.
Counsel, sure. Opinions are opinions by the court. It doesn't make any difference who signs them.
I understand, Judge. I'm merely referring to
the. If you understand that, then why do you make an ad hominem argument?
I'm not following, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
If you understand that they are opinions for the court, then you do not make ad hominem arguments. It makes no difference who writes an opinion for the court.
I apologize,
Your Honor. The style of argument that identifies opinions by their author assumes otherwise.
My point is simply that it is established law in this circuit that a Rule 68 offer must be, quote, completely unambiguous, and this offer was not. And it must be because Rule 68 puts plaintiffs at their peril whether or not they accept the offer. The defendant must make clear whether the offer is inclusive of fees when the underlying statute provides for fees to the prevailing party, which both of the underlying statutes do in this case. Defendant's offer is not a model of clarity. And if you turn to the actual language of the offer, it appears in the appendix. It's at page 9 and then again at page 13 because we attached the offer to our acceptance of the offer so that at least our acceptance would not be ambiguous. The offer of defendant Prudential Pizza, Inc., and keep in mind that there are two defendants in this case at the time this offer is being made, recites that it, quote, allows judgment to be entered against them. Them, of course, is an indefinite pronoun, but it's a plural indefinite pronoun. So who them refers to is our first ambiguity. The language of the offer continues that the offer is made in this action in the amount of $30,000, including all of plaintiff's claims for relief. There's no reference to costs. There's no reference to fees. There's no reference to what claims for relief, where those claims might appear. It doesn't refer to whether those claims might appear in the complaint or in the amended complaint or in the final pretrial order, which the parties were negotiating at the very time this offer was extended and which was filed 2 days later. There's no reference at all. It is silent as to fees and costs, as in the Webb decision. The offer continues that it is not to be construed as an admission that either defendant is liable in this action. Well, of course, that's nonsensical because if a judgment means anything, it means that if we accept this offer, a judgment will be entered, and of course the defendant will be liable. The defendant has to be liable. The offer continues that the offer shall not be filed unless A, accepted. This is an ambiguous restriction because the defendant has no power over restricting the filing of a document. It has no power to preclude the filing of a Rule 68 offer. There's no protective order in place in this case that would have prevented that. And the offer concludes that it shall not be filed unless B, in a proceeding to determine costs. And the question arises then, if there's a proceeding to determine costs, then what? Then the offer can be filed? Then the offer must be filed? Because the rule talks about the admissibility of the offer. So clearly, that's not what this language is talking about, or perhaps it's not clear. Indeed, it is ambiguous. This court has held that magic words are not necessary in extending an offer under Rule 68. We submit, though, for clarity's sake, to be completely unambiguous, there is nothing magical about using the words costs or attorney's fees when one is extending an offer of judgment. Very simple language to include, and it was missing in this case. Now, the court below reasoned that this offer included fees because it relies on what was pled in the complaint as opposed to what plaintiff was or is actually entitled to if she succeeds on her claims. But, for example, if one looks at Rule 54C, the judgment rule that applies when a default judgment is entered, and, in fact, this is defendant's fourth counsel. Previous sets of counsel at various times did not appear in this case. We sought default judgments. It didn't happen. But had it happened, a court would be required to enter judgment for all of the relief the plaintiff is entitled to, whether or not plaintiff prayed for it in their prayer for relief or whether or not it appeared in any filings with the court. So you can't judge it by what appears in the complaint. Finally, the court below did not award interim fees here, and it did so on a fine. I'm sorry.
I must say I don't understand this bit about interim fees. Since this case is over, what bearing have interim fees on anything?
Yes, Judge, and we understand that defendant argued in its brief that because final fees were ultimately awarded, that plaintiff was no longer injured by that. I think what defendant meant to say is that
I don't even care whether you're injured. The idea of interim fees is that in long-running litigation where, say, the plaintiff has prevailed on the merits but damages remain to be determined, district court has discretion to make an interim award of fees when it's perfectly clear there'll be a fee award at the end. But this case is over. It's reached the end. Who cares anymore what a court could have done in media res?
2 points, Judge. One, the court's decision was based on its inability to award fees because no damages had been awarded. And that's just flat wrong. Buchanan teaches differently. You don't need damages in order to have an interim fee award. But here we have a situation where this same conduct is capable of repetition yet evading review.
Let me try it from a different angle. If you win, the last paragraph of the opinion is going to say, the case is reversed with respect to the interim fee order, and it's remanded to the district court with instructions to, and help me complete that sentence.
Well, I would love to, Your Honor. Our position would be that with instructions to enter the fee award against both defendants consistent with the previously entered fee award, which has been entered against.
Suppose you lose the Rule 68 argument but win the interim fee award. What does the judge do on remand?
Say it again.
Suppose you lose the Rule 68 issue, but win on the interim fee. What happens when you go back to the district court?
I think in that situation it is moot, Judge. But the situation.
Suppose you win the Rule 68 argument, and there's going to be a hearing on your fees.
Well, but that's the question. Are we going to have a hearing on the fees, or are we going to just have a decision based on the already filed fee petition, or are we going to revoke the offer altogether and go to trial? I don't know any of those things.
You can't revoke the offer.
I didn't think so either, Your Honor, but I've seen it done in the district court. I've seen district court judges revoke or rescind Rule 68 offers notwithstanding the jurisprudence of this court.
The rule does not allow that. It ain't happening.
It may happen in the district court, and we just don't see it. So.
But that's my point.
There's one district court.
Okay, it doesn't happen in the northern or southern districts of Indiana. But again, my point, the other seven districts of this, the other five districts of this circuit later.
My point is simply that we could go back and we could ask for another interim fee award. It's capable of happening in this.
You can't ask for an interim fee award when there isn't any interim. The case is over.
Not necessarily. We don't know what Judge Coleman's going to do. She might decide that we're going to proceed with trial.
No.
We could give some directions
on this.
All right.
I think you're invited back if she orders that.
That may well be. I've reserved the remainder of my time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your time has just expired, counsel. Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Your Honors. Zane Smith on behalf of the appellees. It seems to me that the first step in the inquiry is to determine whether or not there's any ambiguity in the language of the Rule 68 offer. And the ambiguity question should be limited to the ambiguity regarding the issues of attorney's fees or costs. In this case, the Rule 68 offer is pretty clear.
Yeah, it's completely silent on the subject. That's clear to me.
It is not, with all due respect.
Silent offer on a subject just doesn't cover fees and costs. Where in the offer is there a discussion of fees and costs?
In the reference to the claims in the complaint.
And what makes attorney's fees part of the claim? That's the critical step. You assert that attorney's fees are part of a claim in civil rights litigation, and I don't see how that's true. They're separately authorized by a separate statute, whether it's 1988 or the provision in Title VII. Under Rule 54D, they are separately awarded. They're not part of the judgment. And after the separate award is made under Rule 54D, they are separately appealable. Now, given those facts about the legal system, in what sense are attorney's fees part of the claim?
I agree with the court's recitation of the law. The reference here is to plaintiff's complaint. Each and every count.
That's not even said in the offer itself.
Right. Yes.
It doesn't
sir.
Even refer to the complaint.
Yes, sir. It does.
Where? If the offer wanted to say this is for everything you've demanded in the complaint, that would be interesting. But that's not what it says.
The offer itself says. Allow judgment to be entered against him in this action the amount of $30,000, including all of plaintiff's claims for relief.
Yeah, well, plaintiff's we're back to the question whether attorney's fees are a claim for relief. Under Rule 8,
that's
the core definition of a claim for relief. A claim for relief, no, this is just basic civil procedure, counsel. A claim for relief under Rule 8 is your grievance with the other side. It is not the remedy. The remedy is separate from the claim for relief. But in any event, attorney's fees are separate from the remedy for the claim.
Attorney's fees are considered in Section 1983 claims or civil rights claims, or in this case, the Polygraph Act, as an award of costs.
Exactly. And costs are not part of the claim for relief under Rule 8.
They are part of the claim for relief in plaintiff's complaint. In plaintiff's complaint, in each and every paragraph, she makes a specific request for costs and attorney's fees in addition to the other claims
for
relief.
Suppose she didn't do that. Does your theory, we know that whether the plaintiff asks for it explicitly or not, it can be awarded, right?
Correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So under your theory, the outcome here depends upon incorporating some other document that's not actually specified in the offer, but it depends on how that other document was drafted, right?
Well, in answer to your question, if plaintiff's complaint did not make a request for costs and attorney's fees,
mm-hmm.
I think the plaintiff would have a good argument before this panel.
Okay.
But they did. And if the plaintiff can't look at his own complaint to make a determination as to whether or not it included costs and attorney's fees.
Let me follow up, though. How do we know whether we're talking about an original complaint, an amended complaint, a case management plan that specifies claims for relief, or a final pretrial order?
It does. In this particular case, it doesn't matter because all of that list included costs and attorney's fees.
But under suppose those documents are different. Then your offer is ambiguous?
Well, I would argue.
I'm assuming you didn't write this offer.
I would argue.
If you're the fourth lawyer.
I would argue that the complaint that would be referenced would be whichever one was in force and effect at the time of the offer of the judgment. And in this particular case, if the plaintiff had an issue, if he was she was concerned about whether or not the attorney's fees or costs were included in this offer of judgment, all she had to do was look at the plain language of her own complaint.
Let me ask this. Language that I see in cases, particularly that have been removed, the prayer for relief seems to occasionally end with, and all other relief that is proper in the premises, and I've never understood exactly what that meant, but what would your Rule 68 offer do to that?
I don't think that language in and of itself would be sufficient. I think there has to be a reference to cost. I think actually in this case the reference to cost is even more persuasive than the reference to attorney's fees, because the Section 1983 and the type and kind of attorney's fees were here would be considered costs. I've been on the other side of that many times. It is under the umbrella of costs. Those reference to costs and attorney's fees are laid out in the plaintiff's complaint. I can't imagine, I can imagine a lot of things, but I think it's very persuasive in this case that the reference to those costs should be enough to defeat any question of ambiguity.
But have we ever held that a Rule 68 offer included costs or attorney's fees when the offer did not specifically refer to costs or fees? Nordby did.
The cases that I've seen all are on one side or the other. There's either a complete absence of any reference.
Have we ever held that a Rule 68 offer included costs and fees when there was no specific reference in the offer to costs or fees?
I don't know the answer. I'm not aware of any. I'm not either. But this poly, I will say, there's absolutely a dearth of law on the polygraph issue of attorney's fees. There's nothing. Neither side could find anything on this particular issue.
But this is covered by federal rules of procedure rather than the state polygraph law, isn't it?
It is. In regards to the section interim fee argument, I don't know how much more I can say than what's already been said. It seems to me that because it's the interim issue is really not an issue that is...
Has plaintiff been paid any part of the substantive judgments that have been entered?
No.
Why
However,
not?
Plaintiff has refiled the case against the company that took over Giordano. So they actually have another complaint pending on these exact same issues.
Because they haven't been paid under the agreed judgment.
No, because they have some theory that they think the subsequent purchaser of Giordano's is somehow, of Prudential, rather, is liable.
Well, it may be. Who knows? But the defendants that agreed to these judgments have not paid a penny on them yet?
They have not paid a penny on them, and nor has there been a demand for payment. There's never been a demand for payment. There's never been a citation issued. There's never been a request.
There's
saying,
an order from a court that says pay. What more do you need?
Well, I guess I need my determination is how much am I paying?
Well, you start by paying the amount that is undisputed, $30,000 for the company, and was it $10,000 for Apostolo?
Apostolo, yes.
And they haven't paid a penny. What are you waiting for?
Mm-hmm. Prudential has no assets. They're gone. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to them.
What about Mr. Apostolo?
He's, in my humble opinion, judgment proof.
So you're not being paid?
I am not. Matter of fact.
So I wonder what this is about.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our final